Welcome to the first of the reading series of this year. My name's Tom DeHaven. I want to do a few thanks before I introduce the first reader tonight. I want to thank the College of Humanities and Sciences, the Department of English, Cabell Library, and Barnes & Nobles. As I said, my name is Tom DeHaven, and I've been here at VCU a good long time. Long enough to remember when the place was comprised entirely of shabby old brick row houses interspersed with some brutalist buildings from the 1960s. It was another planet, another plane of existence, that place, as different from the new VCU as, say, Earth is from Asgard or a corn dog is from duck leg confit. And I mention the old VCU because Mary Lou Hall, our first reader tonight, knew it as well as I did. We arrived here at roughly the same time. She to finish her undergraduate work, and I to teach in the English department, primarily in the graduate creative writing program. We've known each other about 25 years. At first, she was my student, and later, and ever since, she's been my friend, a most cherished friend. We bonded over fiction, over our mutual love of fiction, principally the writing of it, and the bond has stayed tight because no matter what's gone on in our individual lives over the span of those 25 years or so, great, good, not so good, outright crummy stuff, we've recognized in each other a common way of seeing our struggles to make fiction. It's a calling. It's not just a vocation or a profession. It's something you're compelled to do and can't not do. As much as sometimes it's the last thing you want to do because you've lost the thread or you've lost your confidence and started to believe you're not doing it skillfully and well. Did I say sometimes that happens? Often. It happens often. It has to me and it has to Mary Lou. But the thing about a calling, both the good thing and the bad thing, is that it won't let go. It won't shut up, and with some courage, you'll always rehoist that traveling sack full of characters and ideas and bits of business and that old battered tin mess kit of grammar, and you'll follow. You'll go where you're called. When Mary Lou Hall became a graduate fiction student of mine, she was brimming with talent and ambition, literary ambition, as most graduate fiction students are. But she was also, as I well recall, beset by serious doubts, something more graduate fiction students ought to be. This was especially apparent when she was a member of the very first novel workshop at VCU. And that's 1992, and that's the old VCU. Let me tell you how the old VCU. That was a conference room in one of those brutalist buildings that was actually modeled after the interrogation room in the Fifth Precinct. It had a door that you came through in this little skinny room, and you know, it was one of those kind of places where cop would come in with a cup of coffee and a pack of cigarettes and a file folder and sit down opposite you. But that's where we had the novel workshop. And it was also the old VCU because we were drinking champagne. At the end, whenever somebody finished a manuscript, whenever finished a draft of a novel, we got a bottle of champagne. We didn't care. It was in a school building. We drank it anyway. So that's the old VCU, 1992, Mary Lou and me. As I was saying, though, it was especially apparent Mary Lou's doubts when she was a member of that very first workshop at VCU. Did she have the chops, she wondered, something to say? Did she have the legs and the breath for such a marathon? Doubt is never bad, though. Like deadline panic, it's one of the muses. Yet despite her doubts, Mary Lou always wrote with joy, and that was the key. And that's why we're celebrating tonight the publication of her first novel, Wirewalker. It's why it happened. It's why the book is here in the world. Ever since those early days in the 1990s, Mary Lou has taken joy in the act of writing, in the mystery of making things up, of breathing life into characters, and then loving them. Whenever I've talked shop, so to speak, with Mary Lou, in a classroom years ago or in a bar last spring, that's what I've heard, loud and clear, a great and an unconditional, a warm and a bemused, a delighted and a tenacious love for the characters who live in her stories. That's the key to this art and the secret of practicing it over a lifetime. a key that Mary Lou Hall has always held tight in the palm of her heart. Love your characters, all of your characters, the easy-to-love good ones and the morally corrupt stinkers. Otherwise, you'll never experience the most humanizing and transcendent, as well as the very tenderest aspects of this calling to write fiction. A few years ago, I was doing another novel writing workshop. It was something like the 10th or 11th that I'd done since the one Mary Lou was part of. And it just so happened that while it was going on, Wirewalker was accepted for publication. I invited her to come in and speak to the writers one afternoon, and she was gracious enough to say yes and to sit at the table with everyone and talk about her experiences wrestling with fiction and living her life as a writer. I recall vividly two things about that day. One, as the class went on and I saw the rapt, growing ever more rapt attention with which those young writers hung on her every word, I began to suspect that there might be a mutiny. I'd be tossed out of my ear and she would, by acclamation, become their instructor. Have I mentioned that Mary Lou is also one of the best and most generous college teachers I know? And the second thing I remember about that day, I remember it most vividly, is how she talked about what it's like to write fiction, a novel, in solitude for years on end, and then to discover that the work somehow had failed to live up to her expectations. But that was okay, she said. It was all right. No regrets, no tears, goodbye, because after all, it's the doing of the work that matters. It's the invention and the shaping, the form-making that gives the best and the most sustaining pleasure. It's the process that delivers the joy. It's the attention to the calling that makes the career. And always and fundamentally, it's loving your characters, those realer-than-real characters of thin air and words that make a writer's life so fulfilling and so damn interesting. She was magnificent that day in that classroom, and now it's time for her to be magnificent again right here. Ladies and gentlemen, my dear friend, and, he said with deep pride, former student, Mary Lou Hall.
Hello. Thank you, dear, dear old friend, Tom DeHaven. And I don't mean you're old. I mean, we've spent a lot of time together. Tom, indeed, inspired me and encouraged me through two novels that I put on the shelf. And one stays in the attic and one has gone into the trash because they didn't fulfill what I wanted them to fulfill. And they didn't feel quite alive to me. And I've thought if they couldn't feel alive to me, they couldn't feel alive to someone else. So I put them away. And then a story came that did. And this is that story. And I'm so lucky that that happened to me. And I hope it happens to me again. I've started writing three different novels since this book went through its last revision. And both of them are on the shelf as well. But I'm hoping that this next thing that I have in mind will be like this story, and that I will, as Tom said, fall in love with the characters. Clarence Feather, the protagonist in this story, is a 14-year-old boy, recently 14 years old, and he's the first character I can say I have fully fallen in love with. And so I present him to you now. A little context is just, I read in the Style article that was so generous about this book and about me, that the book was based in Richmond, and I want to say that it's not. It was inspired by some experiences and observations I made as a resident of Richmond. One of the most pronounced was a friend of mine that worked in a restaurant with me years ago, whose brother, older brother, also worked with us, who had, at 11 years old, been made a drug runner by his brother, who was a dealer. And so his brother had kind of decided to leave that life. And my friend followed and became a busboy, but that tension of a trusted family member putting a young person in that kind of position stuck with me. And then I ran into some experiences here in Richmond that furthered my curiosity about what that kind of world might look like, and that turned into this story. So I'll start. We find Clarence on the day of a dog fight. It's his first dog fight. He lives in a household, and much of this book is based on research that I did that sprang from these experiences and observations I made in Richmond, but the research is what informs a lot of the story as well. And he lives in a household with two men. His mother is dead, a few years dead, and his father and his father's best friend, who's called Johnny Price, not only have him running drugs, but at 14, it's his time to be sort of initiated into the world of a dogfight. You probably already know that where there's dog fighting, there's almost always drug trade. And so that's the link there. And I'm also reading this because I think this is the part of the story that early readers have shied away from, because I love dogs. And one of the reasons I'm writing this story as well, that I wrote it, is because there's a dog in the story who becomes a presence in this kid's life. And so he has to walk through that conflict of being in a world where dogs are functioning in one way and falling in love with a dog at the same time. So the worst that it's ever going to get in this book for you as a reader, in terms of dogs, I need to tell you that because I'm sure there are dog lovers out there we're going to take care of right here. So this is the day of the dog fight. Clarence had both why and the fight. And I'll tell you that Y is a rival kind of drug dealer, dog fighter to his dad and this friend, Johnny Price, whose name is always said Johnny Price as if it's one name. Clarence had both Y and the fight on his mind as he walked to the Quick Buy to get his dad's noon cup of coffee. On weekends, his life was better if the coffee was waiting when his dad rolled off the sofa and stumbled into the kitchen. At 11:30, Clarence would start walking. And by 11:55, he'd be waiting on the back porch while his dad leaned over the sink, spat, then ran himself a cloudy glass of water. When his dad finally turned around, Clarence would step in, hand him the coffee, and then leave as quickly as he came. He'd gotten good at buying time, at knowing when he needed it. Today was a fight day, and his dad would be extra ornery or stupidly happy, and stupidly happy didn't last now that his mama was gone. As he passed Gina's house, he noticed some young dude versions of Y standing around in her yard, admiring a fence that seemed to have popped out of nowhere. They weren't all that much older than Clarence, but they talked like men, running their hands across their dripping faces, bragging about putting the fence up, muttering foul-mouthed smack about who'd done more work and who should get paid the most. A towering dude with tiny braids glanced up at Clarence as he passed, giving him the slow Y boy nod. Clarence dropped his eyes and picked up his pace. He knew Mona was right over there in the living room window as he passed, and Mona is the dog that he's met once, but who has already filled his imagination, just so that you know. And he is starting to believe that he can speak to her in his mind. So he knew Mona was right over there in the living room window as he passed, but he kept his eyes fixed in front of him and refused to look back at her. He couldn't let the Y boys see that he cared about a dog, especially on the day of a fight. But he still spoke to her in his mind like he always did when he walked by Gina's house. As best he could tell, no one could get into his mind, at least not yet. "I see you, Mona," he thought, and he realized she could hear him. He didn't know how any more than he'd known how she'd watched him as he slept, but he sensed her presence like he sometimes sensed the presence of his mama, as a warmth settling in his blood. As he opened the door at the Quick Buy, he found himself wondering if Mona was listening in. Then at home, as he handed his father the coffee and slipped out the kitchen door, he realized he was telling her things he's never told anyone. "They're testing me," he said to her silently, taking the back steps two at a time and wandering off down the alley. "I don't know how to be. I don't know how to be what they want." He wrote out the day by keeping his feet moving. He knew Johnny Price and his dad were thinking big thoughts about him in the night to come. He just wasn't sure what those big thoughts were. But he knew one thing most definitely. The him he'd been up to this point was not the him he needed to be later. He just hoped the him he needed to be showed up at the fight. He walked as the afternoon grew gold, then orange, finally bluing into a deep hazy dusk. He talked to Mona all day long, wandering the same alleys and sidewalks he always did, but today the walking had brought no relief. He passed the Quick Buy once more and then forced himself to turn down Bedford Street. It was time to go home. It was time to face whatever was to come. By the time he passed back by Gina's house on Bedford, Mona stood alone on the other side of the new fence, and the Y boys were gone. It was strange seeing her out in the yard without Gina, just the flimsy, see-through fence between the two of them. He wasn't scared exactly. That wasn't the feeling. The feeling was a vibration in his backbone, something like the one he'd get when the grown-ups raised their glasses to him, but quieter. Less like someone hollering, more like someone humming. He took his time walking over to the fence and then laid his hand against the wire. "I see you," he said, and Mona ambled her largeness over, curled herself up onto her back legs, and settled her front feet on the fence above him. You'll have to note that Clarence is a very small 14-year-old. He's tiny. They call him Itty for Itty Bitty. She was taller than he was, much taller if he counted how far up her paws reached above her head. On any other day, he would have backed off in fear, but at this moment, he had a hum in his body, some desire greater than fear, and so he closed his eyes, kept his hand on the fence, and waited. Seconds that felt like minutes passed with his eyes closed and his hand on the fence. He listened to himself speak to Mona in his mind. "Hey, Mona," he said, hoping that this might be the day she'd finally answer him. In front of him, just inches away, he could hear her breathing. He could smell the rot of her warm, fishy breath. Then, all of a sudden, he felt her tongue slap it against his hand like the slimy back of a catfish. It was a feeling he both loved and hated at the same time, like when he was little and his dad used to tickle him until he cried. Clarence always came back for more, too, often taunting his father, a man who suffered from what his mama called a short fuse, but who back in the day knew how to keep that fuse from blowing. When he thought about it now, Clarence could see he'd almost always been a boy who came back to the things that scared him. He thought about his dad's tickling, thought about Mona, and then he smiled, realizing there was no one around to see it one way or the other. The air felt cool on his wet teeth, and he liked it. He was getting tired of keeping his smile locked up behind the hard, straight line of his pulled tight lips. So he smiled again. He kept on smiling. Then he opened his eyes, looking up into the baby blue eyes of the dog. "Hey, you," he said. Mona nuzzled her pink nose into the shape his hand made against the fence, and once again, the hum passed through his body like music. "Hey, girl," Clarence said. "I see you, girl. You're a good girl now, aren't you, Mona?" Mona's name had barely left his lips when he heard the voice behind him, Y's voice. "Sup, boy?" Y asked. Clarence kept his face right next to the fence. He kept looking into the eyes of Mona. "That dog likes you, don't it? That's a real big dog now, ain't it, boy?" Clarence could tell from the way Y's voice circled him, dancing, that he and Mona were together in the wrong place at the wrong time. "Well, why don't you bring that dog to the fight tonight, Itty? That is, if you're coming. That is, if you're allowed to come, is what I mean." "Oh, I'm coming," Clarence spat. And as he looked into the almost human eyes of Mona, he suddenly felt afraid. Not of her, and not even of Y. He could hear Y's feet kicking asphalt, moving in the direction of the quick by, away from him. He was afraid of the boy he'd been all day, 14 years old and talking to a dog in his mind. He was afraid he was starting to like that boy, the very same boy who'd be heading to a dog fight that night. "Don't look at me," he suddenly said to Mona. And he took his hand off the fence and wiped it on the front of his jeans. "Don't look at me like that dog," he said. And he turned and walked toward home. When he got home, Johnny Price and his dad were sitting at the kitchen table, listening to sports radio and drinking beer. "So how you doing there?" Johnny Price asked, grabbing Clarence and pulling him in close, then rubbing his knuckles on Clarence's head until his scalp burned. "Just look at your little old self. Gotta toughen you up, Itty. Those dudes don't mess around in high school. When Clarence was younger and his mama was alive, this would have been just a tickle. But since her murder, these two tickled him with sloppy hands. In what used to be her house, a little bit of pain meant all was well. In what used to be his mama's house, his one and only goal was to keep the pain under control." "I'm fine," he mumbled as he freed himself, then kind of stopped and stood there in the middle of the kitchen feeling gangly. Saturdays were when Johnny Price paid him for the errands he did after school on Fridays, when the three of them had to play act like nothing was happening. They'd been play-acting for over 2 years now, and each of them knew their parts by heart. The Clarence was starting to tire of their little production. "So I've got a little something for you, my boy," Here it was. It was time for Donnie Price's voice to dip low, grow thin and quiet. His green left eye twitched into a clumsy wink while his brown right eye sat still and glassy. Clarence's dad nodded, then shot Donnie Price a look that was at first hateful, then as blank as a board. This was his usual look for Donnie Price and for Clarence these days. The nodding was all part of the act, but the dead look, that part was for real. His dad took his time getting up from the table, stretched, and let out a dramatic make-believe yawn. "The beer," he said, pointing to his stomach as he headed down the hallway to the bathroom. "Can't hold the beer for anything these days." It was true that his dad couldn't hold his beer, but that was the only honest thing being said in the kitchen at that moment. Once his dad was gone, Johnny Price reached into his pocket and pulled out a wad of money, fanning the bills out like a poker hand. Johnny Price was playing his part too, though Clarence was starting to wonder why either of the men bothered. It wasn't like the truth of the matter would change anything. It wasn't like he could walk away and do anything but what they wanted him to do. "Take something extra this time," Johnny Price said with a grin that showed plenty of teeth, but no joy. "Big ones, little ones, you choose. You done good, my man. You always do good work for me." Clarence took two 20s and just stood there in the fluorescent light, folding the bills into squares. It was his turn to act, but today he didn't have it in him to pretend to be grateful. "You ready for the fight tonight, then?" Johnny Price changed the subject, leaning back into his chair and yawning. Clarence nodded because he had to, but he didn't look up from his hands. He kept folding the 20s into smaller and smaller squares. He was trying to forget the part of him that had awakened that morning, the part that knew something bad was about to happen. His mama never tolerated talk of dogs in the house, and she would never, no matter what his age, let her own son go to a fight. But his mama, she was gone, and these two men were all that was left. "You know it's just the big guys get to go to the fight," Johnny Price assured, and he pulled Clarence in close again, knuckle rubbing the top of his head more gently this time. "So I guess you're one of the big guys now, huh?" Clarence felt his mouth fall into a hard straight line on its own, no effort necessary. "Yeah," he said, "I guess I am." The drive to the fight wound through a neighborhood no one seemed to live in. Tired-looking houses with dark-eyed windows leaned, and broken-down cars littered the empty streets. It was hot, even now after dark, the wet, clinging hot of someone breathing down your neck, making threats. "This heat is angry heat," his dad would say some evenings, holding dripping cold beer bottles against his red-rashed neck. This was his way of explaining what might happen later, what he'd blame on his Irish temper in the light of the next day. But Clarence wasn't convinced his father was Irish. Being white didn't make a man Irish, and neither did red hair. He'd met his so-called Irish grandparents once, and they didn't seem any different from any of the other white people who would look at him, then at his dad, then at his mama, then quickly look away like they'd just seen an accident. But with his mama gone, the white people's eyes lingered. There was no reason now for them to mind their manners. Their eyes settled where they pleased, openly searching for the link between the black boy and the red-headed white man, for that missing puzzle piece, the one that was dead. At times like these, his father's lips sat sealed, but even in silence, Clarence could hear him screaming. "Keep walking," he'd eventually mutter, laying a hand on his son's shoulder and tightening his grip. And so Clarence walked. He just kept on walking. It seemed like Johnny Price drove a long time deep into the fight neighborhood until finally the empty houses became tall brick buildings with long broken windows. Then there were fewer buildings, then hardly any buildings at all. In time, Johnny Price pulled up to a long cinder block garage that sat back from the road behind a patch of skinny dead trees. Clarence told himself that the feeling in his stomach came from the heat, angry heat, he thought, and then he thought scared heat, and then he stopped thinking. He followed his father and Johnny Price across a patchwork of streetlight scattered out across the dirt, and Johnny Price knocked on the wood of a high fence that squared off the backyard of the building, a fence that was higher even than the fence at Gina's. In a moment, the fence opened wide enough that Clarence could see a mouth full of teeth gleaming there in the half-dark. "Parked on the street somewhere," the mouth said, and the open crack narrowed. "Cops," the mouth said, and then the fence slammed shut. His dad and Johnny Price stood there for a while, just looking at each other, basically doing nothing. Sometimes it took him a while to come up with a plan. There were sounds coming from the other side of the wooden fence, friendly, happy sounds, like the kind at one of his dad's glass-raising parties. These sounds briefly changed the feeling in Clarence's stomach, made it almost flutter with excitement. "I'll move the car," his father finally said, and then Clarence felt a hand on his shoulder. "I'll wait here." Johnny Price nodded at his father, and Clarence moved himself in a little closer so he could feel the man that was made of Johnny Price's muscle and bones, but not close enough to seem afraid. A few moments passed, and then he heard Johnny Price's voice above him. "You know, you've always been kind of soft, Eddie. Not your fault. I mean, your mama babied you like you were a little girl. But this night, this is a big one, and I'm mighty proud of you." His left hand gave Clarence's shoulder a little squeeze. "It's always been like you were my own son, you know. You must know that by now." Clarence wished Johnny Price and everyone else would stop calling him Itty, and he also wished that his mama's name would be kept far away from topics like dogfighting. But he knew Johnny Price had just paid him a compliment, and lately compliments were hard to come by. "So where's Nasty?" Clarence knew that Nasty was the dog Johnny Price intended to fight that night. He felt like this was the time he should say something about the fight, something that would take his mind off the fact that he could feel Mona sniffing around the corners of his mind, trying to get his attention. He tried to imagine what it was like, two dogs fighting, wondered if it was like people fighting, only with teeth and claws and no words, all sounds and pain. He wondered what made men gather around to watch it, raising animals to be killers. He thought of Mona. "Nasty's already in there," Johnny Price said, casting his gaze out over the dirt around the building, then out beyond the ramshackle street, toward whatever lay beyond the orange street lights, sweating in the darkness. It was always this way with Johnny Price and his gaze. It was like he knew someone was watching him, and he refused to be surprised when they rounded the corner, speaking his name. "So you scared?" Johnny Price asked. Clarence knew this was an important question. He knew, by the way, that Johnny Price's hand had been on his shoulder one moment, but wasn't there anymore by the space that now lay between them. "Nah," he lied, and he wondered if Johnny Price could tell. He could feel Mona listening in. He knew she could tell. "They're just dogs, you know," Johnny Price said. And then he pointed to the spot where Clarence's father was now stepping from the shadows, his hair a shimmering sunset in the amber light. "Just keep remembering there's nothing but dogs, Itty. Keep remembering this ain't nothing but a thing." He opened up the gate, walked in, and then turned back to Clarence. "Come on now," he said, and Clarence followed him. Inside the big square fence was a smaller lower fence that formed a kind of pen. People stood around the pen, drinking beer from cans, and music drifted out of the open door of the cinder block building. A couple of hard-haired women in high pointy shoes stood on the building's back steps, swaying. Y stood a few feet away from them, watching them dance. When Clarence walked in, Y glanced over and nodded at him. "Where's the dog, boy?" he silently mouthed, and Clarence felt his face go hot. "There he is. There's Nasty," Johnny Price suddenly said, and he pointed to a dark corner of the pen where Clarence could make out the shape of a dog chained to a big metal stake. "I don't know where Y's dog is," Johnny Price added, spitting into the dirt. "I don't know but that he doesn't have a dog at all." "True that," Clarence's father agreed, and he walked over to a plastic tub and pulled out two wet cans of beer. He handed one to Johnny Price. "No sodas here, I don't think," he said, looking around the yard. He opened his beer, took a sip, and then handed it to Clarence. "Have a taste," he said, and he glanced over at Johnny Price. "A big night," said Johnny Price. Clarence's father grunted in agreement. Clarence raised the can to his lips. Once the beer hit the inside of his mouth, he realized it tasted like what pee might taste like if you got it real cold and then poured it into a can. Not that he'd ever tasted pee. It was just the first thought that came to mind. What he really wanted was a Mr. Pibb and a bag of Andy Capps, but he went on drinking 1, 2, 3 gulps on account of the fact that his dad and Johnny Price stood, nodding there in front of him, and that beyond them, over by the swaying girls, Y slumped against a railing, watching, drinking his own beer, and nodding. Seemed almost everyone was watching him and nodding. Apparently he was doing something right. "Whoa now," said Johnny Price, suddenly grabbing the beer from Clarence and handing it back to his father. "Like father, like son," he kidded, and Clarence watched his dad's body stiffen as he took one step forward toward Johnny Price. "That's right, my son, my beer for my son." Clarence looked down at his feet, which was always the best bet when the two of them started in on each other. He noticed that since his mama had died, his father was usually the one to do the starting, and more so with each passing year. Way back in the day, the two of them had been all jokes and tall-ass tales, and he remembered that these were what they'd called the good times. These days, the good times were harder to come by. "Well, I'm about to get this show on the road, don't you think?" Johnny Price nodded at Clarence's father, and then both men turned so that their eyes, though shadowed, were burning a line in the direction of Y. Y still nodded, watching the women dance. Over in the back corner of the pen, a low rumbling sound came from the throat of Nasty, while at the same moment, the women backed up flat to the fence, and a young dude was all but dragged down the building steps by a lanky pit on a short, gleaming chain lead. Y grabbed the lead out of the kid's hand and choked it up tight, pulling the dog in close to his body. "This is Black," he yelled out into the yard, but the white dog's name remained a mystery to Clarence, as there was nothing black on its body but the marks around its eyes. Y walked the dog through the crowd of people who backed up and let them pass. As Y chained Black to his own stake in the pen, Clarence thought the dog didn't look so different from Mona, just smaller, and part of him wondered if its breath, too, smelled like rotting fish. Mona, the super dog, the dog that could see and hear everything. Around him, people were moving in closer to the pen, opening fresh beers and lighting cigarettes. Johnny Price elbowed his way over to the pen to the corner where Nasty panted. Someone turned off the music inside, and the yard hushed, just the murmur of voices and the growling of dogs. A man with a handheld spotlight elbowed his way up to the pen and fastened the light onto one of the corners that didn't hold a dog. "Welcome to the show," he yelled out into the yard. "Last bets have been made inside," he added. And then he stepped back and gulped the beer that one of the dancing women had handed him. In the far right corner, Johnny Price leaned over the pen and attached his hand to the back of Nasty's collar. In the front left corner, Y did the same with Black. Inside the pen, the dog's eyes were fixed on each other. Behind them, the men's eyes were fixed on each other's eyes. The man with a spotlight held a hand up in the air and started raising fingers. "One, two, three," he said, and then he yelled, "Fight!" And before Clarence knew what was happening, the dogs were free and on each other, lips pulled back to show teeth and gums and thick white spit. In a split second, they were raised up on their hind legs like humans wrestling. Then they started moving their mouths, going at each other's necks with wildly grinding jaws. They are eating, Clarence thought, his stomach churning with cramps like from the belly sickness when he couldn't leave the bathroom for hours. They are eating each other's faces. Clarence felt his father's hand on his shoulder. The white pit's face was wet and red with blood, but it was hard to know which dog the blood belonged to. But Clarence could see, as Nasty raised his head to get a grip on Black's ear, that the blood was coming from a wide-open wound that had replaced Nasty's throat. Nasty folded onto his back legs, and Black, jaws thrashing, went in for the neck again. "He will eat him whole," Clarence thought as the crowd began to scream, "Black, Black, Black," like a chant. "He will eat him and there will be nothing left but blood." Clarence sank to his knees and tasted blood himself just before the backyard went black. That is all. Thank you. Thank you to the VCU Visiting Writers Series for letting me be here. Thanks.
I'm Clint McCown, and I want to say this seems to me to be the perfect way to start our new reading season, and also the perfect way to inaugurate this year's reading series in this room where we will be holding our future readings. And it's perfect because this evening we've got a reader who represents a long history with VCU in Mary Lou. And now in Hannah, we have a reader who represents the future. And I'm very pleased that she's with us this evening. Every now and then, we faculty members get to serve on committees that actually make a difference. And it was my good fortune to serve on one such committee last year, the job search that brought us Hannah Pilvinen. Her debut novel, We Sinners, received the prestigious Whiting Writers Award and the Balcones Fiction Prize. In the presentation of the Balcones Prize, her work was cited for its austerely beautiful prose that shines with surprising profundity that reminds us of the uniquely illuminating power of fiction. The Washington Independent Review of Books called it a stunning debut novel, describing it as having been written with precision and potent detail. USA Today said that We Sinners is the rare mainstream novel that treats faith with respect and subtlety, conveying both its power and pull. The Los Angeles Times praised it for being remarkably funny for a book about a deeply religious family grappling with loss of faith. It's this last quote that may be one key to what makes Hannah's work so strong, because it speaks to her tonal range. In fact, so does her list of other publication credits, which include Harper's, the New York Times, New York Times Magazine, the Chicago Tribune, and the Wall Street Journal, among many others. Hannah got her undergraduate degree from Mount Holyoke College and her MFA from the University of Michigan. And she's been awarded residencies at the McDowell Colony, Yaddo, the Fine Arts Work Center at Provincetown, and Princeton University, all of which signify both her success as a writer thus far, as well as her potential for the future. And that future is almost here, as she's finishing up her second novel, Drum Time. Hannah described this second novel as more dramatic than her first. She says it's got hysteria, affairs, murder, and reindeer herding. I have to say I've never encountered that combination before, but I do look forward to it. But one thing to remember is we don't hire people here on their writing strengths alone. They have to be teachers. And a great writing talent combined with a great teaching talent is a rarity. We have found that combination in Hannah. And it's my pleasure to introduce her now to our VCU family. So please welcome Hannah Pilvinen.
I'm very, very happy to be here. I want to say a word of thanks to Clint for that really lovely and touching introduction. And one thing that's already struck me about being here in Richmond is how welcome I feel. And it's really special. And it's great even to see a few of my students here. And I'm already enjoying their earnestness, their smarts, and I'm really looking forward. And so I thought on that note, I would actually do something. I'm actually not going to read from either We Sinners or the book I'm working on, in part because actually just today in class, I was talking to my students about writing about things that have really high stakes and what that really feels like and writing into discomfort. Then, of course, you start thinking about yourself and you're like, gee, do I really do that? So this is a story I've been working on for quite a while. Actually, about 2 years. It has nothing to do with my work. And I became, during my time as a fellow at Princeton, I taught a class there called Writing the Other, and I became really interested about the questions of writing into race and writing into whiteness and what that really uncomfortable confrontation might look like. So this is my attempt to both be brave for my students, for myself, and try something out. And my agent is sending this out soon, so maybe this will be like a good look. I don't know what. Housewarming. So I'm going to read part of this story. It's called United Snakes. The borough was Brooklyn, and the year was now. And the weather wasn't humid yet, but the mornings threatened it. And the afternoons neared the new, exciting heat of summer, which would become, soon enough, unbearable. The neighborhood was east of Williamsburg, but still west enough to be considered newly white territory. That is, it was embarking on whiteness, the migration of gentrifiers having spread now from the warehouses to the row houses, their buildings and apartments and grocery stores beside each other and yet entirely apart. And how was that, she wondered. How did they, we, differentiate our places of living or eating or drinking so clearly that you never saw, for instance, the Hispanic men getting beers at the bar they had built? She was walking down her street, newly her street, she had just moved there, and she was not used to this neighborhood yet. The children on the stoops, their parents not in sight, litter lingering on drooping snowbanks, old men collecting bottles from the recycling bins. She wanted to like her street. She wanted to like the music playing out of cars, the doors of the cars hanging open, the Hispanic men and women hanging off of the hanging doors. But she did not like it because she felt they did not, could not like her. But then she thought, on the other hand, she ought to grow to accept the discomfort of her whiteness. It was important to be having this experience of her whiteness. Yes, she would learn from it, grow from it, etc. She was naive in this way and in many ways. At the moment, she was walking around the corner to make a copy of her keys. She was feeling optimistic about the possibility of friends coming over to her studio and sitting on her fire escape, maybe smoking on the roof. And she even had the audacity of hope. Obama slipped into her mind, slipped out, to imagine she would give one of the keys to a boyfriend she had not met online. She worried she was jinxing herself by making the copies, but she felt hopeful. And on days she felt hopeful, which were rare, she made an effort to fortify her hope, to float it along if she could. The hardware store was around the corner along Knickerbocker. Many of the streets she was noticing bore the residual evidence of the previously Polish neighborhood it had been half a century ago. And when she entered the store, she was pleased by its cramped quarters, which seemed very New York, very Brooklyn. There were, for instance, 7 kinds of mouse and rat removal devices lined up at eye level on the wall. The counter was raised from the floor, and the woman who looked down at her was black. She was watching a show on a small television. The woman's hands, briefly touching hers, were warm. There was the stink of singed metal, the grind of the drill. She paid, leaving, feeling pleased, an errand done, a new store discovered, and she was halfway down her block, having stepped over not one but 2 desiccated piles of dog shit, when the form of a gorilla jumped out at her from behind a line of garbage cans. The gorilla was, of course, a man in a gorilla suit. But the time it took to realize this was too long. Her parasympathetic system had already kicked in. Her flight response was activated. She put her hand to her heart, feeling much too much like her mother, like Carrie on Sex and the City. But she was only instinct now, only a body. Oh my God, she said. From across the street, she heard more laughter. 3 men sat on a stoop and murmured in Spanish, laughed in Spanish. She thought of her aunt's poise, the time her aunt had tripped walking away from the altar at communion, how her aunt had managed to rise demurely, and she tried to emulate this, but the man in the gorilla suit lumbered alongside her. "Hi," she said, "did you need something?" She felt not like herself, but she needed then to be someone else, someone who was not new to the neighborhood, someone who was not young and white and female and single. But these were the things she was, and she could see no way around them in the moment. The man in the gorilla suit made admirably accurate gorilla noises. At the door to her building, she despaired of how long it took her to open the door. The new key felt flimsy and would not turn. She could see in her peripheral vision that the gorilla was down the street, but her nerves were still nerves. At last, someone came up behind her and edged the door open with a push of the shoulder. "Someone doped the lock a long time ago," a white girl said. "Doped, doped," she said as she walked up the four floors to her apartment. Once inside, she hurried to the window in her bedroom that overlooked the street and, for a few minutes, watched the gorilla man frighten others. He tried to frighten a mother, young, Hispanic, pushing a stroller, but the woman rolled her eyes and said, "You are some kind of stupid. You got a kid and you're still pulling this shit?" and kept moving until her baby, frightened maybe, began to cry, and then the mother became mad and yelled at him in Spanish. The mother's head, shaking, was aggressive, dismissive. He took the head off of his gorilla costume, and his forehead was wet with sweat, and his hair was curly but not long. He looked to be in his 30s. He put his hands in the air to gesture surrender, but as soon as the woman moved away, he put the gorilla head back on. She called a friend to tell the story, thinking it would diffuse the feelings, but her friend probably thought she was calling to complain about her ex and didn't pick up. She called her mother, who was probably drinking wine in her bedroom or napping it off. She called her father, who left his phone on silent. At the bodega, she bought a six-pack and drank four. For a week, she slept heavily, buoyed by more beer, until she knew the bodega owners, who smiled at her forgivingly each evening, once giving her a free lighter with her cigarettes, telling her to get some sleep. She looked tired. Time passed, a week, 2 weeks. The new paint on the bookshelves dried, the floor washed, began to sprout kernels of dust. She had rebuilt her bed for the fourth time in 4 years, though the screws had stripped and the frame would not outlast even a tepid round of sex. But she had no plans for sex. She was done with having sex just to feel wanted. She didn't recognize people here, which was part of the point of the move. No avoiding the gym, no waiting for the train at the far end of the station. She saw the woman with the stroller more than anyone else. Sometimes at night when she walked home from bars, the woman would be there out on the stoop. Sometimes her husband sat with her. They moved aside for her when she approached. Sometimes their relatives, she assumed, came to visit, and the building smelled like meat. How she missed meat and grease, but then she would feel her fat. She was getting her father's belly. All the weight went to her stomach, just like him. She had porky legs, just like him. She wanted to be one of those thin girls who wore slouchy shirts and made looseness look elegant. But so far, such chicness required more dedication than she could muster. She tried to be skinny. She tried to only order vodka sodas. She went to bars full of people who looked like her. The third drink was when things felt okay again, livable. The fourth drink was when she became aggressively friendly. She teased two men sitting by her for drinking pale ales. They were friendly back, if distant. She was outside smoking her last cigarette when the gorilla man came walking by. She considered her alternatives, ignoring him, acknowledging him, fleeing. But she was loose from the drinks now and wanted her cigarette, the whole thing. She wanted to smoke it right down to the butt. He was alone, and his white t-shirt looked clean, almost pressed. He wore a do-rag. He had nearly passed her when she said, "Hey, gorilla man." He turned and, recognizing her, laughed. "Mamacita," he said, "I knew you knew a joke when you heard one." He clapped her shoulder. His hand was heavy. "Come have a drink with me," she said. "Nah," he said. "I got some good stuff at home. You want to come over?" I work tomorrow, she said. What do you do, some secretary shit? I work in education, she said. I analyze the efficacy of urban nonprofit education programs. She tried to say it sarcastically so he knew, she knew, it sounded pretentious. That's important, he said. Education's important. You want to know something? What? This country is fucked up, he said. The United Snakes of America. This country is fucked. I went to school. You tell them that. You tell them what their education did for me. Basically, nothing. That's great, she said, not sure what to say. But you know, I know what people think of me. Yeah. What do you mean? A group of other white people had come outside to smoke, and she noticed they weren't talking, just watching him talk. He was talking effusively, his hands waving. Yeah, he said, man, I'm sorry about that gorilla shit. It's okay. I had a bad day. Yeah. You wouldn't even laugh. You wouldn't even scream. Man, we tried, though. She smiled. She tried to embrace this as a compliment. Come on, come have a real drink. We got some good tequila. Okay, she said, surprising herself. It was a bad idea. She knew it was a bad idea, but she didn't care. She enjoyed walking away with him, the people at the bar thinking it was a bad idea, knowing it was a bad idea. He lived on the same street with her, she reasoned. She wouldn't go inside. That was what she would do. She wouldn't go inside. At his building, the children scattered on the stoop like birds. He pushed the door open with his shoulder, and inside there was the immediate stench of pot. But the foyer was nicer than her own. At least it was lit, and someone had washed the steps recently. They walked up to the fifth floor, so she was tired by the time she got to the top, out of breath. Inside, the music was loud, and a few men sat on the couch in the living room watching TV. He brought her a drink, tequila in a plastic cup, no ice. She hated tequila. It reminded her of poor decisions. She sipped it cautiously. She needed to get out of there. Why was she always like this? Why did she always say yes when everyone else said no? Her mother had always said she was a difficult child, unruly, impulsive, irreverent. She told herself she was smarter than that now. She had her life more or less together. She had a separate door to a bedroom. She's a teacher, he told the man on the couch. Teach us something, one of the men said. He might have winked, she couldn't tell in the darkness. Yeah, this girl, she's smart, the gorilla man said. She's fixing up the United Snakes. You want another drink? He poured more tequila into her cup. What do you drink? Another man asked. What do you teach? The other man asked. I don't. You like music? Gorilla asked. Yeah, she said. Of course. You like that Dave Matthews shit? No. Like what then? She hesitated, not sure whether the truth was damning. I don't know, she said. Normal stuff. She saw briefly her father singing along in his truck, Desperado, Desperado. Someone was dancing in one of the bedrooms. A couple, the woman sliding down the wall, the man gyrating near her face. The woman was smiling, laughing. Gorilla saw where she was looking and put his hand on the small of her back. She smiled, laughed, as if it were a shared joke, but he held her waist with his left hand. She swayed slightly, awkwardly. Her drink was going to spill, so she drank it down and coughed in her hand. He turned her around so she wasn't facing him and held her by her hips. The summer dress she had on, a loose jersey knit, rode up, and she hated the idea of him noticing she hadn't shaved her legs. She turned her face towards his and said, I don't want to sleep with you. It seemed important to say. She was proud of herself for saying it. She thought of all the times she ought to have said that before. The next song came on, a faster one, complete with auto-tune sirens. She reached her hand out to another man, pulled him towards her. She danced between both of them. She laughed at them, accepted more tequila from someone, and passed it to the other man. She noticed suddenly how handsome this other man was. It slowly registered in a new way that he looked like her ex, except for his hair. He looked like a postcard. He looked like a past she hadn't had. He looked like the future she was supposed to have had. She wondered why a black man was there. She wondered if he had some claim to Hispanic blood. He was so thin, his jeans might have been tight, but weren't. She studied him, or tried to see how he was or wasn't her ex. She felt a sudden shame to be attracted to someone so much like her ex. Shouldn't she desire someone not like her ex? Shouldn't she desire someone as far from her ex as possible, someone hefty and white, someone without opinion, someone who didn't care whether she failed to fold the afghan after she rose from the couch? And I'll stop there. Thank you.